This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This week, the Vermont Senate has taken up a wide-ranging electronic privacy bill that would apply to data from a broad array of sources, license plate readers, phone calls, even drones. It was fast-tracked through committee, and the full Senate votes on it today. We're going to look at what's in the bill and what isn't from one of the bill's sponsors. And then later, we'll hear from the ACLU of Vermont and the Sheriff and States Attorneys Association about how they feel about the balance of personal privacy and the needs of law enforcement. I'm joined in our Montpelier studio now by Tim Ash, Chittenden County Senator and co-sponsor of the Electronic Privacy Bill. Welcome back to the show, Senator Ash.
Thanks, Jane.
So let me ask you, broadly speaking, before we get into some of the details, what problem you're trying to solve with this legislation?
Well, I think it's really twofold. One is I think it would be no surprise to people in Vermont that over the last 20 years in particular, as the Internet's taken wave and with different technological advances, that technology has just outpaced almost any other aspect of our lives. And the old-fashioned sense of having a personal or private life sometimes comes in direct conflict with that technological advance. So part one is really trying to ignite a conversation amongst Vermonters about what it means to have a personal or private life in the modern technological era. The second part really is on the technical side, where the bill really gets into the details, which is what reasonable balance is being struck in Vermont between legitimate law enforcement and commercial uses of technology with a person's right to privacy. And that's everything from the electronic communications and texts and phone calls we make on our cell phones to the expectation of some privacy in terms of your whereabouts at any given time. And that's some of the issues that the bill tries to get into.
Are we behind on this? Should we have already had a bill like this?
Well, I think the great advantage in Vermont is that our law enforcement officials are really top-notch, and that goes from the local level all the way to our state police. I think in some states, and we're watching this in the news all around us, most states can't say with such pride that they have great, high-integrity law enforcement of the caliber that we have in Vermont. So just culturally, we're in a good place starting out. We find ourselves really in the vanguard in trying to come up with laws that strike this right balance. The state of California, Maine, New Hampshire, I would say, stand out as leaders in trying to put in statute the right balancing act for law enforcement and citizen privacy. Vermont is now joining that club.
I want to get into some of the things that are in the bill, like how long law enforcement can keep information from license plate readers around and that kind of stuff. But I was curious because you said that one of the two main aims of this bill is to start this conversation or to have this conversation with Vermonters about what the idea of a private life online in the digital age means. How do you structure that idea?
Well, I mean, you know, there's that old Robert Frost poem about fences make good neighbors. Well, it used to be fences also helped separate neighbors, and you could do things in your backyard and be private. Well, just put this in perspective. There is now a satellite company called Planet Labs, which has 71 satellites orbiting Earth, and they are going to be able to take a picture of every inch of Earth every day. Well, you can imagine the types of business activities or government that would want to purchase those images. So for me, it's trying to say, how do we take the typical Vermonter and their normal activities of life and make sure that they can feel secure that their activities aren't being constantly watched, retained, commercialized, or inspected when you haven't done anything wrong? And that's really part of the technical aspect of the bill that we've tried to take on.
All right, we're going to tackle that. And since Senator Ash talked about satellites flying and taking your pictures, we're going to start with drones. And listeners, if you have a question, if you've been following S-155, if you've been looking at what's in this omnibus privacy bill, and you have questions about some of the details, we're live here in the noon hour. I understand it is supposed to be voted on, final vote by the full Senate in the 1 p.m. meeting of the Senate. So this is coming right up today. So if you have a question about some of the details or you want to tell Senator Ash, your thoughts on what you think of the bill. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. All right, so let's talk about drones. Speaking of what you can and can't do in your backyard without people being able to see you, this bill regulates when law enforcement can use drones, or more specifically, what they need to do in order to be able to use a drone. How does it do that?
Well, and first I want to make an important distinction between what I would call commercial or hobbyist use of drones. We know that at the holiday season, somewhere between 500 and 700,000 drones were being purchased.
Not just in Vermont.
Not just in Vermont, thank God. So pretty soon, coming to a backyard near you or a 4th of July parade, there'll be hovering small crafts, if you will. The bill focuses primarily on law enforcement use of drones. So these would be those smaller unmanned craft that are sometimes used for things like border control by the federal government, but here in Vermont might be used to do various investigation or surveillance operations overhead. And we believed in the committee and in the Senate that if law enforcement is going to utilize overhead images, that they have to get a warrant to do it. Otherwise, we're going to be in a constant surveillance state before we know it. And so there are a few exceptions to this rule of thumb that they would need to seek a warrant, and that would be in the case of someone who's in danger of either being killed or immediate serious bodily injury, a missing person. Those are the kinds of...
What about a natural disaster or
Natural disasters... whether it be law enforcement, that would certainly be allowed. We know that when the train derailment occurred recently in Vermont, a UVM lab actually went up and was the first in getting those aerial images that many people were able to see. So we create very reasonable exceptions, if you will.
What about something like the Donald Trump rally in Burlington last week?
The Donald Trump rally poses a very interesting question, because what we expressly prohibit is the use of drones for the investigation of crimes without a warrant. Public safety is really what you're describing, and in that case, the bill attempts to allow law enforcement to use that in a reasonable manner. We would expect that that be made aware to the public in advance, but that's going to be one of those areas of turbulence. You can't write a bill that really captures those gray areas in between, because I think it could be said that there's very reasonable public safety reasons to be able to respond quickly for something that might get out of control.
But your bill would prohibit the use, say, so let's just, I know this is hypothetical, but just to help people have a sense of what actual situations might be like, something like that big event in Burlington where you had supporters of Donald Trump and opponents of Donald Trump and a lot of people expected to converge on Burlington, downtown Burlington. Officers would not be allowed to then, while they happen to be surveying the crowd to make sure that public safety is taken care of, oh, there's a suspected drug dealer who we know lives on this side street. Let's just do a little surveillance and we happen to see something. They wouldn't be able to use that evidence that was collected.
Well, that's a good question for the sheriffs and state's attorneys who will be on, as well as Alan Gilbert from the ACLU. Certainly, if that was a subterfuge, if you will, to put this thing up in the air in the first place, that would be a problem. But really what it's avoiding is someone saying, well, we have a suspicion that Jane Lindholm might be up to no good, so let's get a craft to hover around her house every weekend and see what's really going on, even though they don't have probable cause that there is a crime being committed. That's what we're trying to avoid in the bill.
Got it. And so to recap, they would have to get a warrant for investigative
purposes.
That's
correct.
We got a call from Dennis in Cambridge. Let's go right to you. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I would start with saying that technology is always going to outpace the law, and we need to change our approach from saying that intrusive technology is allowed until outlawed to intrusive technology is not permitted until specifically supported. And I'd point to license plate readers as a good example of this.
So for license plate readers, Dennis, you'd like to see it not allowed until
it
can be proven.
I'd like to see it put before the people before it's implemented and records are kept for who knows how long.
Dennis, thanks for your call. Senator Ash, could you speak to Dennis's broad point, and then we will actually get into license plate readers because that's a part of this bill.
Well, it's certainly a valid way of looking at it. One of the challenges is that usually the technology is out and proliferating before law enforcement or legislators or executive branches even know about it. This is not just true in these kind of technological situations, but in various commercial applications. So there's no magic approach to that. In the case of license plate readers, I should just mention that they were being used by several dozen law enforcement agencies without the legislature having any clue they even existed. And so one of the things this bill does is tries to constrain the way those are used, who can access the information, how long the information is stored, and so on. I'm certainly sensitive, though, that some of these technologies do rise to the level of being so worrisome that we should be in the business of permitting them rather than deciding after the fact to prohibit them.
But in the case of something like license plate readers, you can't in advance try to anticipate what might be used at some point and then ban it before it's in existence.
License plate readers are a perfect example. While we can do our best to make sure that law enforcement isn't just doing willy-nilly collection of information about people and holding it forever, we struggle with commercial users of this information. There are repossession companies around the country who literally pay to put cameras on tow trucks that drive around in big cities or at sports stadiums, and they're just constantly picking up those plates to see if anybody owes money to the bank, and then they quickly, anytime they get a hit, they send it back to the repo man. But one of these companies now says that they have taken images of 40% of all vehicles on the road in the United States. They're not just thinking about repossession when they store that data. They're thinking about how they can sell this information for marketing purposes and many, many other things. So we have this hybrid challenge, controlling our own behavior, our own government's behavior, but then also what happens when it gets in the hands of commercial users.
All right, but that sounds terrifying, and your bill doesn't address that, does it? Does it address commercial license plate readers?
Well, until we figure out how to deal with interstate commerce here, just as the state of Vermont, I think we're going to keep running into that problem.
So in terms of law enforcement use and a retaining of information from license plate readers, the bill as it stands now says that law enforcement can retain those records for 18 months. Why 18 months? What's the magic number there?
Yeah, and there's certainly it's a art, not a science. The 18-month retention period, and for listeners, what that means is that the license plate image picked up of where you were yesterday, the state of Vermont would be able to hold on to that for 18 months, then have to destroy it unless law enforcement needed that to continue to investigate a case, in which case they would go to the court to preserve it. We believe that 18 months is a sufficient amount of time both for law enforcement to use legitimate information for the detection and investigation of crimes, also to be helpful in the case of missing persons. The technology, as it's been deployed in Vermont, has been helpful in very few cases, to be honest with you, and I think VPR has done some fine reporting in that regard. That said, if someone goes missing and we suspect one or several people who may have abducted a child or something like that, it is possible that we would pick up the whereabouts of that plate over a period that might be more than just a month or 6 months. And that's why that 18 months, we believe, provides enough breathing room so that the data will be useful. But at a point where it's no longer useful, we don't want to leave that door ajar that would allow someone to misuse the information and suddenly we just want to know where Jane Lindholm's been at night or during the weekend or the same of any legislator or any other private citizen.
That's only really useful, though, if you're back timing, right? Because if you are already starting an investigation and you're on the lookout for a specific license plate moving forward, you'd be tracking that. So really, it's only that you'd be able to look back up to 18 months to see, oh, well, where has this vehicle been? Where have we maybe picked it up?
Well, imagine an abduction occurred in the city of Burlington. God forbid that it happened, but let's say that were to occur. And evidence came out maybe 7 months later that the person who's now a suspect had headed on Route 2 east towards New Hampshire and Maine. And then the law enforcement official in Burlington could submit a request to the state's database to find out if any of the License plate readers being used either by state police or any of the law enforcement officials along Route 2 had picked up that plate. So it's just as you say.
But I realize that, you know, 10 years ago we didn't have this technology, but 10 years from now, couldn't that be an equal argument that, oh, this suspect has been identified as a suspect 7 years after a disappearance, and why not just keep it in perpetuity then?
Well, and there are some who have argued for that, and that's one of the reasons the committee had to strike some reasonable balance between the two positions. The likelihood that information that's that old would be helpful in any real investigation or any real-life scenario is very, very low. We've already seen the utilization of this technology paying very low results in terms of cases solved. But, you know, we're in the world we're in where the technology's out there now, and we're trying to be reasonable with law enforcement without creating a database of your whole waking life.
I'm talking with Senator Tim Ash. He's one of the sponsors of the Electronic Privacy Bill, S-155, that is up for a vote this afternoon as we record here live in the noon hour. In the preliminary vote, it was a unanimous approval for it, so the assumption is that this will move forward pretty smoothly this afternoon, right?
That would be my expectation. I think people in the Senate have actually been really fascinated as we've talked about all the different iterations moving forward. And, of course, the bill can't tackle everything. Commercial users of drones is just an example where if legislators aren't hearing it now, within 5 years, my guarantee, if we're both still here for this show 5 years from now, we will hear issues in every municipality, every neighborhood about the use of commercial drones. We're going to have 4th of July parades where well-intended people are going to fly a drone over to get great images, and it's going to land on someone. Someone's going to get hurt. We're going to hear people flying into people's backyards and taking images either to bother them or inadvertently. So the commercial use of drones right now is regulated by the FAA, so we did not enter that territory. But legislators are now newly aware of what they should expect in the future.
Well, and Aaron would like to see some of that. He writes in, "I understand the need for this bill, but I and many others are more concerned about our privacy rights rather than criminals. When will the legislature address drone use by private individuals that infringe on my privacy and property rights? This is more important to most Vermonters who are law-abiding." So another call there to look at that. Let's get into at least one more thing that's in the bill, and this is electronic data and how law enforcement, again, is able to collect that data, retrieve that data, and what kind of permission they need to get. So this applies to things like text messages, emails, and the IP addresses where you access the internet from. What were you trying to do broadly around electronic data?
Well, I think two things. The first is to make sure that Vermonters knew who could access what information, when, and for what reason. And the bill is really the first, best, comprehensive place in statute that says what information is protected, what can be shared, what can be accessed by law enforcement, and when you have a reason to believe your telecom provider might be sharing information that you thought was private. In the old days, I send a letter to you, Jane. The only two people who know the contents are me and you. Well, now there's several intermediary steps, and so many people actually retain that information in ways that they didn't before. The second was really to separate out, for law enforcement purposes, the barriers that they had to overcome, if you will, in order to access different types of information. So if I send an email to a friend of mine and law enforcement is thinking that perhaps there's some sort of illicit activity being transmitted, the contents and the thought processes that are encapsulated in a text or a phone call or an email, the probable cause, i.e. getting a warrant, would be required to access that information. For what I would call a lesser type of or category of information, like whether I'm a subscriber of AT&T, my mailing address, my billing address, things like that, the bill says that a subpoena would be the slightly less standard. That would be not a fishing expedition barrier of entry, but it says there has to be some decent chance that this information is useful for the investigation of a crime.
And not just mailing address, but IP address, the actual, you know, the physical address of where you're accessing the internet from. That also is the exception to the warrant rule. So law enforcement will just need to get a subpoena for that.
That's right. An IP address is basically a numerical ID code, if you will, for most computers. This is an area where I think your subsequent guests will have some debate, and the committee struggled with this as well. one of the things we learned about IP addresses is that frequently people who are engaged in illegal activity online, say child pornography, things like that, the IP address itself is very rarely an indicator of who the person is. It's not as simple as saying, oh, we know the IP address, let's go to his or her house. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're very sophisticated in their behavior and will have one IP address that leads to another IP address. And it on and on and on. So it infrequently is actually useful in terms of identifying a offender or someone who's alleged to be committing a crime. The committee did struggle. The opinion on the committee was not unanimous, but landed on the side of what I would call the law enforcement side on this one, which was to, rather than require a warrant, only require a subpoena.
I have to let you go back to the State House, but I just want to highlight for people who may have thought that this was in the bill originally, no longer in this bill is a question of recourse for individuals if their electronic medical records are shared or leaked or somehow get out publicly. That was in the original bill. It was stripped out, I understand, partly to get it through quickly so that this bill could be voted on because that was likely to be fairly controversial or maybe not pass. So nothing about electronic medical records in the bill as it stands
now. What we do in the bill is enshrine HIPAA in Vermont statute for the first time.
That's the privacy rights.
And that's the privacy rights. Any identifiable health information, it enshrines it in Vermont law in a way that it wasn't previously. For those who really do suffer damages as a result of their medical provider inappropriately sharing information about them about a disease or mental health situation with somebody else that's not supposed to receive it, the bill does provide a kind of a kickstart to their ability to bring a case in a state law. But it does not allow for automatic damages for even inadvertent releases of information. That's correct.
It sounds like many of the compromises that were made in this bill fell onto the side of what law enforcement wanted. Are you satisfied with the bill as it stands?
Well, I'm satisfied in that it's a first leap in really trying to put in statute reasonable expectations of privacy. There's a long way to go, and I think that what we see now on the electronic records, electronic communications, the drone piece, the license plate readers, in each instance, the starting point was much more heavily weighed against privacy rights. So while, of course, some, including myself, who want to err on the side of citizen privacy in almost every instance, the starting point was much inferior compared to where we're at with this bill.
Is that a yes? You're satisfied?
For now, I'm very appreciative of where we're at, and I think we'll learn lessons and improve upon it in the future.
That is Tim Ash. He's a Democratic Progressive Chittenden County Senator and co-sponsor of the Electronic Privacy Bill. Thank you very much for talking with us about what's in the bill.
It's been the pleasure of my day.
We've been looking at the details of what's in that bill. Coming up, we're going to get responses from the ACLU of Vermont and the Department of State's Attorneys and Sheriffs. Both organizations have been vocal participants in trying to influence the details of the bill. And we'd like to hear your take. What do you think about this bill? Does it strike the right balance in your mind? 1-800-639-2211 is our number, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're looking at an omnibus data privacy bill being fast-tracked through the Vermont Senate. In fact, the Senate is supposed to vote a final vote on it in just a few minutes as we broadcast here live during the noon hour. We just heard from Senator Tim Ash, one of the sponsors of the legislation, about exactly what's in it. Now let's turn to some opinions from major stakeholders. And listeners, if you'd like to add your thoughts to the mix, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Joining me here in Montpelier is Alan Gilbert, Executive Director of the Vermont Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Hello, Alan. Nice to talk with you again.
Glad to be here.
And from White River Junction, we're joined by David Cahill, Executive Director of the Department of State's Attorneys and Sheriffs. David Cahill, a pleasure to have you on the show as well.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So we'll get back into the nitty-gritty in a moment. We got a lot of the details about what the bill says from Senator Ash, but I'm curious, generally, if both of you are in agreement that this is a bill that is needed in Vermont right now. Alan Gilbert?
Something had to be done. I mean, Senator Ash was correct in what he said, that so much has changed in the last 10, 15, 20, 25 years around privacy, mainly because of digital technology. it was good to finally get on paper what have been procedures for getting some of this information, and that's a lot of what the electronic communications privacy part of the bill does. But the discussions that were had in the last year, particularly in 4 days of testimony in October over drones, automated license plate readers, what electronic communications privacy is, and the medical right of private right of action for breaches of medical records, I think those conversations really help to educate people and begin to realize there's more work to be done, but this is a good first step.
David Cahill, what's your perspective?
So the federal law on this topic is now 30 years old, back before cell phones, the internet, and certainly before drones. And it's high time that the law catches up with technology, and frankly, that we write a law that is flexible enough to adapt with technology. And I think the Vermont bill does do both of those things.
Are you satisfied with the idea that law enforcement will now have to get a warrant in order to do drone flyovers for investigative purposes, David Cahill?
So drones today, in my view, are where smartphones were 10, 15 years ago. We don't yet understand all of the legitimate and all of the illegitimate uses for this technology. And I think that this bill is a good first attempt, and we're going to have to come back and tweak it because there are going to be circumstances that we just didn't think of the first time around.
Like what? Do you have an example in your head of what that kind of circumstance might be?
Well, I can tell you, back in 2002, I had no idea that I was going to use a smartphone for all of the reasons that I use a smartphone today. And I'm not going to try to predict what I might want to use a drone for in the year 2020.
I can certainly respect that and understand that, but it almost sounds like what you're saying is we should give law enforcement the ability to, you know, to have this freedom for something that you're not even able at this point to articulate.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. To the extent that this bill restricts law enforcement use of drones, that is fine. And when we bump up against circumstances where law enforcement wants to use a drone for a novel purpose and law enforcement is impeded by being unable to use a drone, we can come back to the legislature, articulate the use, and ask for permission.
I see. Do any departments that you know of in Vermont currently have drones that they use for investigative purposes?
None that I'm aware of.
Alan Gilbert, what's your stance on the way the drones are regulated by law enforcement in this bill?
One thing that people need to know is that police can use drones in this bill. They just have to get a warrant. I mean, this comes up all the time. A warrant is not, my understanding, is not particularly difficult to get. In fact, you can use email, apparently, to get one. We don't think that throwing out 250 years of protection through the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizure by requiring a warrant before information can be gathered, we don't think that's unreasonable, especially regarding drones.
And it sounds like David Cahill doesn't either. So on this point, you think this is a good first step to say we require warrant use for investigative purposes.
Well, he talked about coming back to the legislature for possibly getting changes, and that always makes our antennae go up.
But as it stands right now in this bill—
Yes.
That's a good provision.
It is a good place to be.
What about electronic license plate readers, automatic license plate readers? I understand that's something, the 18-month rule, that this is how long they'll be able to store that information. That's not something that sits well with you.
No, and this is a terrific example of mission creep in the digital world because ALPR systems, automated license plate reader systems, were originally designed to catch bad guys, people who were wanted on an outstanding warrant, driving with a license suspended, that sort of thing. A hot list is developed every day. If you are caught during that day because a ping goes off, you're driving by a car with one of these systems, you can be arrested. We don't have any objection with that. What we object to is a system like that being turned into a surveillance system. And that's what retention of data for the period that's now allowed, 18 months, really does. It turns ALPRs into much more than a criminal detection system. It really turns it into a surveillance system. We wanted 24-hour retention of the data with a provision that if law enforcement had a good reason to want to keep any data longer, they could apply to a court for a preservation order to preserve the data on the day that maybe somebody was abducted, and that order would be granted. In fact, the preservation order could be extended. We think that that's a reasonable way of dealing with the problem of staying away from creating a surveillance society, which we're really doing in small steps through something like this.
Let me just make sure I'm clear on what you were suggesting that could be allowed, that idea of retaining the information on the day that somebody, for example, is abducted. You don't mean a specific license plate number. You mean all of the data that was collected on that day. They could
Correct.
Request to have that
Correct.
Stored.
Correct. That could be done. I mean, you could probably store the data, all the data that was collected on Thursday, January 14th, 2016, or the next day or the next day after that, if there was a reason to think that down the road that might be valuable.
David Cahill, what about this argument that this is basically creating, in small steps, a surveillance state?
Well, I guess what I'd say is that if there were going to be a surveillance state, we would already have it. Our neighbor just to the west, New York State, does have fixed position license plate readers that enable the true bulk collection of license plate data on highways and on critical infrastructure, especially around the New York City metropolitan area. In Vermont, as a matter of policy and as a matter of resources, we do not do that. And I expect that whether this bill passes or not, that will not be how we operate in Vermont, because it's not the Vermont way.
Alan Gilbert, do you think we already have a surveillance state?
Yeah, I think we all have cell phones in our pockets or our purses right now, and that is a device that's a very complicated computer that happens to make phone calls, but it's also a tracking device. So anytime that's on, your location can be determined within 15 to 45 feet. And when you think about it, it has to be that kind of a device, because how else can you make or receive phone calls? But we're living in a surveillance society because we like the convenience of being able to make phone calls from anywhere. We like the convenience of credit cards. There's just all sorts of digital technology that's built into our lives that really adds up to a lot of surveillance of all kinds of things that we do and retention of that information.
But aren't we tacitly agreeing to that for the conveniences that you mentioned?
Oh,
why
yeah.
should law enforcement be hamstrung in a way that the general public and private companies aren't?
That actually is a problem, because we've gotten so used to the convenience that we no longer question it. And we really should be thinking every time we do something electronically what exactly it is. When you surf on the web, you're giving information to data aggregators about the things that you're interested in. The difference is that police should not be collecting information about us unless they have a suspicion that we've committed a crime or are about to commit a crime. You know, they are not a member of the public that can just be curious about anything that's going on. They really deal with making sure that the people who have committed a crime are caught. And we have no objection to collection of information about those people as long as the rules that are established are followed.
David Cahill, what gives you the biggest sigh of relief in this bill that you say, yes, this was tackled in exactly the right way and this was needed?
Well, the sigh of relief came very early in the process when the leaders of Senate Judiciary asked the ACLU and us to work together to try to find some common ground and use the recently passed California Electronic Privacy Act as a starting point. And we did succeed in doing that, and there's a lot more in this bill that we have in common than where we differ. And I should note that, you know, at least seven other states have passed Electronic Communication Privacy Acts, and this one is, if passed, would be one of the most protective of individual rights, while also fulfilling a lot of the needs that law enforcement has to investigate serious felony cases.
What about the concern that we heard earlier from our listener, Dennis, who called in to say things should basically be prohibited until they've been proven to be useful and effective and safe? So there should not be an assumption that a new technology comes along and law enforcement has a right to use it as it sees fit because it hasn't been specifically prohibited. Instead, there should be just sort of a general prohibition on these new technologies until they've been approved.
Gosh, well, I suppose that's a discussion about the relationship between the individual and private sector technology. And there's an intersection between that and the American way, because the American way is about innovation and progress and then only regulating to the extent that we need to protect individuals from the negative byproducts of the innovation. And that proposal would essentially flip the system on its head, and it's a much broader discussion than the relationship between government entities and individuals.
Alan Gilbert, what do you think?
Well, one of the interesting things is this is a bill that largely regulates what government, specifically the police, can do. It doesn't regulate what the private commercial world can do. And the one provision in the bill that to some extent kind of did that is the one that got stripped out. And that was the creation of a private right of action if your medical information was breached. That was a big disappointment to us. But I think I understand that taking that next leap, saying we, the government, are going to jump into regulating what's happening in the private world of hospitals and health insurance companies and doctor's offices and so forth, that really made people think that that was a leap too far. It's too bad that happened because I think Vermonters would be very surprised at how low-level security we have on the front end of medical records exchange systems. We thought some protection was at least needed on the back end. That's what the right to sue would have done. But, government and legislative bodies and the courts have always been behind on keeping up with advances in technology. David alluded to that before, and it's really true, and I think it will continue to be true because technology advances so fast that it's just impossible for a legislature, which I think is supposed to work at a very slow pace, deliberative pace, tries to keep up.
Let me just ask you before we go, Alan Gilbert, because you brought up the electronic medical records provision that was stripped out. Are you going to fight for a new bill that would include a right to sue or a private citizen's right to action if electronic medical records are leaked in a future bill?
Well, we're going to try and explain to the House what we explained to the Senate around the importance of the protection of medical records information. And we hope the House maybe takes a different tack in responding to our request than the Senate did.
That's Alan Gilbert. He's executive director of the Vermont chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure.
We've also been talking with David Cahill, who's executive director of the Department of State's Attorneys and Sheriffs. David Cahill, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
And just an update on S-155, the privacy bill we've been talking about. As I mentioned, it is expected to be voted on by the full Senate, a final vote this afternoon. Preliminary votes suggested that this will breeze through. It was a unanimous vote before, widely expected to pass the Senate. And then, as we just heard from Alan Gilbert, there'll be some discussion about what an electronic privacy bill might look like in the House. Coming up on this program, we visit a snowy Vermont spin on Jurassic Park in Queechy. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's some snow on the ground out there now, but it's nothing on the scale of what Vermont was like in the last ice age, the Pleistocene era. In addition to massive glaciers carving their way through the landscape, the state was populated by a whole menagerie of creatures, some familiar, some exotic, and some simply enormous. The Vermont Institute of Natural Science in Queechy has a new outdoor exhibit featuring life-size statues of some of these ice-aged mammals, so visitors can see what these creatures might have looked like over 10,000 years ago. Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen headed down to Queechy this week, and VIN's director of on-site interpretation, Chris Collier, showed him some of the big statues out on the snow-covered meadow in front of the Institute.
One of the exciting things about this exhibit is, you know, as we stand here and look out as the sun is glinting, the sun is out, by the way, the sun glinting off of that snow, this is exactly what we wanted from this exhibit, something that as you drive into our facility, it really draws you in and is reminiscent of the Pleistocene. We would have been covered with snow and glaciers. There were glaciers that went all the way down to parts of Pennsylvania. So as we look at these creatures out in the meadow, it really hopefully draws you back in time to that era when we were covered in snow and ice. And imagine walking out and all of a sudden there's a live mammoth. That would be pretty thrilling.
And about how long ago was the Pleistocene?
So the Pleistocene lasted for quite a while, but it ended, the last ice age ended basically around 11,000 years ago. There's, you know, differing reports. Some will say 13,000 years ago, but nonetheless, that's the rough time frame. So we're not far out of it.
And I can see what looks like a mammoth. I can see what looks like a bear, a wolf. Looks something that looks like a person of some kind. How many statues are there?
There's the camel, the dire wolf, the mammoth, the American lion, the short-faced bear, and you're right, there is a human figure which is supposed to represent a Clovis hunter named for the region where they found specimens in Clovis, New Mexico. So if we go over, so it is slipped, but, so this is a piece done by Wendy Klimperer out of Brooklyn, and she works with recycled metals, and so we got her to loan us this direwolf, and then on the other side of the mammoth over there, you can see the American lion as well. And this creature is just as fierce, not in real life, as it probably was in real life.
Yeah, it looks like sort of like a current-day wolf, except it looks a little bigger, and it's made out of iron. You can see sort of spikes and nails coming out on the top of it in the rough. Was the dire wolf significantly different than modern-day wolves?
Not hugely, but it was larger, still hunted in packs and hunted a lot of what's called the megafauna of the area. And so they were another great predator out there on the open lands hunting large game. So this is Bob Shanahan's version of the Western camel. It's unknown whether or not they had a hump, because that doesn't preserve well in the fossil record. But regardless, they were related to llamas and alpacas. And this one, to me, looks a lot llama-esque. But, you know, one of the exciting things for me is just the way that Bob has incorporated all the different plants into each of these specimens. From a slight distance, it actually looks like fur.
Some of these animals, obviously, like bear and deer, are things that there's some version of around today, right? Whereas something like a lion or a camel or a mammoth, we know from descendants in places that aren't North America, right?
Right, and that's one of the exciting things about this. Who would have ever thought that camels actually began in North America? We always think of them from, you know, other regions in the world, but they actually began and evolved here. The mammoth is kind of the centerpiece that we started with. It's covered in all kinds of plant materials, so it's got a wire frame with wood as the base, and then he kind of makes it fluffy with all kinds of plant materials. This one is covered by cranberry vines and meadowsweet, and the tusks are raspberry twigs. But you can see on the mastodon, its ears are much smaller than what you'd find on an African elephant, and that's partially because bigger ears are not so great in the winter. So it was very cold. They were adapted for that cold climate.
Would any of the predators that we see here have preyed on something like a mammoth?
Quite possibly, especially if it was a smaller mammoth. The young mammoths would have been defended by adults, but, you know, if there was an injury or if someone was able to get them isolated, they certainly would have been taken down. A full-size, large mammoth, you know, a short-faced bear might try to attack it. The Clovis hunters certainly, it's believed, hunted mammoths as well at times.
So this looks like a bear, but it looks a little bigger and it has long legs and sort of a short muzzle. Is this a particular kind of bear?
This is a short-faced bear, and it's the largest bear that ever has been. It would have stood up to 12 feet tall on its hind legs standing up. And at the shoulder, it's a good 5 foot high. So it is very big, very fast, and not quite sure whether or not it was completely predatory in nature, but unlike modern black bears and grizzlies, it was more carnivorous in its nature. It probably scavenged quite a bit, but it also probably predated on lots of large animals.
And is this something that Ice Age humans would have encountered?
They would have, yes. They probably would not have wanted to, but but they certainly came in contact with short-faced bears at times.
What are the theories about why animals like this might have gone extinct?
Well, so there is a big question. Was it climate change that caused the extinction? Was it overhunting? Was it a combination of things? Was there disease that caused problems for populations and wiped them out? And to my knowledge, we don't know the answer just yet. But that's one of the exciting things about science. People are ever learning and trying to figure out those answers. You know, I just really hope that this exhibit gets people thinking and gets them excited about creatures from the past and learning a little bit about animals that they didn't know were here. And also learning more about ones that they did know. Many people know about the woolly mammoth, but now they can come see it at Venn's in the flesh, so to speak.
Collier, Director of On-Site Interpretation at VINS, the Vermont Institute of Natural Science in Queechee, where the Ice Age Mammals on the Meadow exhibit will be there through April. Lawmakers are racing to address the spending caps of Act 46, the state's new school district consolidation law. At the same time, school boards are finalizing their budgets and need to know what they're allowed to spend. Governor Shumlin wants to scrap the caps, but Act 46 architect Representative Dave Sharp says the caps are acting just as they should. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at some of the options the legislature is considering. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.